From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Next week, South Africa enters a new era. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from black and white South Africans who worked to end the apartheid system, often at the risk of their lives. We'll hear from Rian Malan, whose great-uncle was the chief architect of apartheid. Emma Mashinini was a trade union activist. She spent 6 months in prison without trial. Helen Suzman was for many years the only member of the South African Parliament who opposed apartheid. Playwright Ethel Fugard defied his country's policies by writing for and working with black actors. And poet Dennis Brutus spent years in Robben Island Prison with Nelson Mandela. That's all coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. NATO has issued an ultimatum to the Bosnian Serbs: stop attacking the Muslim enclave of Garajda immediately or face immediate Allied airstrikes. The alliance also says the Serbs must pull their weapons out of the town and let UN workers go about their business, or they will face airstrikes. NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner says the alliance is prepared to act.
We still want a negotiated end to the hostilities, but nobody should doubt the resolve of this alliance to protect Garajda against attacks by a determined party that believes mistakenly that it can ignore the international community.
President Clinton says he supports the NATO decision. He praised Secretary General Werner's resolution in issuing the statement.
I applaud NATO's decision, the resolve of our allies, and once again, the leadership of NATO Secretary General Werner. The United States has an interest in helping to bring an end to this conflict in Bosnia. Working through NATO and working along with Russia and others, we are determined to save innocent lives, to raise the price for aggression, and to help bring the parties back to a negotiated settlement.
Mr. Clinton says he is not considering sending U.S. ground troops to Bosnia without a peace agreement. The president has nominated two candidates to the Federal Reserve Board. They are White House economist Alan Blinder as vice chairman and Janet Yellen to a board seat. Blinder's nomination had been expected for some time. He could succeed Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, whose term expires in August 1995. Yellen is a former colleague of Laura D'Andrea Tyson, the chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisers. Today's nominations give Mr. Clinton his first opportunity to affect the powerful central bank. The United States has let a boat of Haitian refugees land in the United States, but President Clinton says this does not mean a change in the policy of repatriating Haitian refugees. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Mr. Clinton insists that his policy of returning Haitian refugees to Haiti has not changed, despite the boatload of some 400 Haitians that was allowed to land in Florida. Mr. Clinton says it was a special case.
These people were only 4 miles from the shore. The second was that we had evidence that the Haitians might have been subject to some abuse by the people who were in control of the boat. And so for those reasons, we thought the appropriate thing to do was to bring them on in, which we did.
Mr. Clinton's policy of returning Haitians, a continuation of Bush administration policy, has drawn criticism from some members of Congress and from Haiti's ousted president, Aristide. Bill Small at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up a fraction of a point at 3,652. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton says she had no knowledge of any money from an Arkansas savings and loan being transferred into her husband's 1984 gubernatorial campaign. Mrs. Clinton is now holding an unusual news conference at the White House to answer questions about her lucrative trading in commodities futures. She is also trying to put to rest questions over the couple's investment in the Whitewater Development Corporation in the late 1970s. United Nations peacekeepers are leaving Rwanda. Fighting there between rebel and government troops has killed tens of thousands of people. The evacuation is supposed to take 2 days. Canadian Air Force planes will airlift 1,400 troops to Kenya. Relief agencies in Kigali say thousands of people protected by the UN troops will be in danger. The BBC's Roger Hearing reports.
The Canadians have had two large transport planes on standby in Nairobi since soon after the crisis began. They've been involved in bringing out Canadian nationals and are now the most convenient means for the evacuation of the UN troops. A spokesman for the Canadian High Commission, Chris Cooter, told the BBC more than 100 soldiers had already been brought to Nairobi. With four flights in and out of Kigali each day, the operation was expected to take no more than 2 days. The Canadian planes will also be taking in much-needed humanitarian supplies to assist the aid workers still in the city. Now the decision has been taken, the UN is clearly keen to get its troops out of Kigali as soon as possible. Although 10 Belgians serving with the UN were captured and killed at the beginning of the crisis, there have been few direct threats to UN personnel since. But given the escalating violence and chaos in Kigali, there's a clear feeling in New York that the peacekeepers are at risk.
Roger Hearing reporting. Again, our top story, NATO is warning the Bosnian Serbs to stop shelling Garajda or face immediate airstrikes. The Serbs must also move their heavy weapons 3 kilometers away from the town by 8 o'clock tomorrow night or face, again, airstrikes. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. White minority rule is about to end in South Africa. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from black and white South Africans who opposed apartheid, often at the risk of their lives. Rian Malan spoke against apartheid from a unique position. His family helped create the system. His ancestors were among the original Dutch trekkers who settled in South Africa. His great-uncle, Daniel Malan, was the principal architect of apartheid and became the first Afrikaner nationalist prime minister. Rian Malan left his country in 1977 and returned in 1985 with the intention of writing a book. I spoke with him in 1990 after that book, My Traitor's Heart, was published. Malan wrote that his father had the uncanny ability to find a moral purpose in apartheid.
Well, I guess my father believed in something called separate but equal. I think he convinced himself that ethnocentricity was such a powerful force that people of various races and cultures couldn't actually get along together. And that it was in everyone's best interests that whites and blacks in South Africa be separate but equal. This was essentially a self-serving delusion, separate but equal.
Did you grow up accepting that?
You know, I don't think I ever really accepted it. I'm not sure I can tell you why, but I mean, I have this very early memory of being in our family station wagon and my father turning to me. We were in a filling station. My father turned to me and said, ask the boy to pump the back tire or something. And I leant out the window and I was going to call this grown African man a boy. And it seemed to me, it suddenly struck me for some reason that this was an impolite thing to do and that I should actually call him sir. And so thereafter, that's more or less what I did. I'm not suggesting that I was more enlightened or anything than the rest of my tribe, but, maybe we're all like that in the beginning. I mean, all Afrikaans children are brought up by black people, and I think it's impossible for that sort of, if you love the people who raise you.
You said that when you were 16, you became a communist, you were also a hippie, and that it was very hip when you were a teenager for suburban white teenagers to be into black culture, but not black African culture, just black American culture. What kinds of things got through? what aspects of black American culture were you into, and why was it American and not African?
Because we lived in the sort of framework of Western culture. I tell the story in the book about playing in a blues band, which my name was Malan, and two of the guys in the band were Afrikaners, too. But the music, we played Howlin' Wolf songs and Sonny Boy Williamson songs, and we were playing the blues at segregated garage parties in John Foster's South Africa at the apogee of the apartheid era, and nobody laughed at us. We all knew the words of We Shall Overcome and so forth off by heart, but I don't think very few of us could so much as hum the tune of Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, which was the African national anthem. That's how it was to grow up in white South Africa.
Was this strictly a white liberal phenomenon in South Africa?
I think it's a phenomenon that was confined largely to the liberal enclaves, the sort of middle and upper middle class enclaves of the big white cities. I think a lot of us had this fantasy that it was our destiny in life to lead black people to the barricades and to freedom. But the important concept there was that we would be leaders. And I think that what we had in mind was sort of middle-class managerial positions, much like the ones that our father owned, that our fathers held, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things that Steve Biko was reacting to when he founded the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, was this assumption on the part of white liberals that we knew what was best for blacks.
Now, you became a crime reporter.
That's correct.
And you say you studied how South Africans kill each other. You must have had something of a dual personality while covering the crime beat. I'm sure the name Milan helped you make contacts with the police. And on the other hand, when you were in the townships, I'm sure it's not a name that you offered too freely to the black people that you were writing about.
Strange that you should mention that. I used to tell people my name was John Black under certain circumstances and certain times. It seemed prudent to do so. But yes, no, I did have a split personality, and as I sit here, I think I still have one. It always seemed to me that there were always two aspects to my personality. I was an Afrikaner who despised what whites had done to blacks in my country. You know, on the other hand, I was a white who was apprehensive of Africans and was scared whenever he went into Soweto. I would not have said so then. I guess I can say so now.
Well, you were, I think, scared for a couple of reasons when you'd go into Soweto. One was that as a white person you felt like a target, and you understood why there was such hatred towards whites by mm-hmm. blacks. On the other hand, you thought that some of your fear was based in racism, based on this just kind of unnameable fear of black people that you were brought up with. How could you distinguish between the two and purge yourself of the racism while understanding when it was appropriate to be afraid?
Well, I don't know. I think that's a question that I've wrestled with my entire life and that I'll probably continue to wrestle with for the rest of my life. I mean, a lot of the fear of the whites have for Africans in South Africa is clearly phantasmagoric. I tell the story in my book of a night when I went drinking in Soweto with a friend of mine. We had several drinks too many, and well, we fell into conversation with some guys who were just, well, they were giving voice to, I guess, a pretty common sentiment in Soweto at that time in the midst of the Greyst Uprising. They were telling me that every white they saw was an enemy to them and so forth. And I had an acute attack of paranoia, so I decided I had to get out of there before somebody attacked me, and I went off walking through the streets of Soweto alone on foot. Now, might sound like an ordinary thing to you to do, it struck me I felt as though I was walking on the moon, and I was quite certain that I'd never reach my car alive. I was in a state of acute terror, and my terror reached a crescendo when somebody tapped on my shoulder, and I spun around, and here was one of the guys who I was sure was plotting to murder me, tapping me on the shoulder with a big smile on his face and said, "Listen, brother, it's not safe for you to be here alone. We'll walk with you." And so there I was, revealed for what I was, that a white man beset by, I suppose, what I describe in the book as racist misgivings.
Rian Milan's great-uncle was the principal architect of apartheid. Milan's memoir is called My Traitor's Heart. Emma Mashinini is a longtime opponent of apartheid and was for years a leader in the black trade union movement. She was the first general secretary of the Commercial Catering and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. In 1981, she was arrested and held without trial for 6 months. The only time she was allowed out of the cell was to be interrogated. She later worked with the families of detainees and political prisoners in her role as director of the Anglican Church's Department of Justice and Reconciliation. Her boss was Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I spoke with Mashinini in 1991 after the publication of her autobiography, Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. She described what happened the morning the police came for her.
They came in several cars, and they were quite a number, more than 10 or so. And when they came, you know, as they would knock at the door, they knock at every window. They kick, they bang, they do everything. You open this door, they are all over. And when they got in, they just said to my family they should get out of the house. And my husband wanted to know why. And they said, "You get out, I'm being detained." And they said they were detaining me under Section 22. And they started searching and ransacking the house with everybody out of the house. I state in the book that after searching, after having done everything, when they were about to take me away, and then they called my family in. Well, there was a pile of books. I do have a lot of books. And then they wanted my husband to sign for those books as things which they were taking away. And he refused and said, how can I sign for them? What if you brought them here to incriminate Emma? And it was a big issue in itself. And then they took me away to my office, to my workplace, to go and search, which is was where the Council of Churches was. And many people came to give me moral support. And they took me to prison. And the first time I was imprisoned in Pretoria Central Prison and locked up with people who are on the death row.
Yeah, so you thought you would be sentenced to death,
oh,
too?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I don't know what for. Because you were just waiting. You see, they're waiting and expecting to hear from them that you will be going to court or doing anything to know why you are there. And nothing happens. And then the next thing, you are just told, pack your bags, come. And then when you go, you think you are being released, yet you are being moved from one prison to another.
When you were arrested, you were the general secretary of a trade union, the mm-hmm. Commercial Catering and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. Mm-hmm. Did they give you any reasons for arresting you? Did you know why they had singled you out?
Never. I did not know up until the day when they left me to go home. The same way they arrested me, the same way they left me, I did not know why they arrested me and why did they release me at the same time. But it was a very horrible time just to be left alone for 6 months in solitary confinement. It was one of the horrible tortures that could happen to one.
Would you describe the cell that you were held in solitary confinement?
The first cell I was held in solitary confinement in Pretoria, I state in the book that it was so clean, small and neat because I reckon I was locked up in a section which I think was must have been reserved for whites or whatever. And the reason for that is they hide you away from even the prison warders or anybody who is working in the prison or any other person that they must never see you or see your face. I was locked up and never was to go out because the toilet and everything is there. They sealed the window and just left a very little strip for them to peep and see me from outside, and I could not see from inside, outside. I could just see the two eyes peeping at me, which was very scary. And even if they brought food, someone had to lock that. The doors were locked until someone would come and just open the door and push the food. I was moved to yet another cell, which was now very huge, big, and very dirty, with no window, windows right up there. You don't see the sun. You don't know what is happening. And it was like it was under the rail because I could hear the trains, you know, the noise of, like, the trains where I was.
Did you completely lose track of what was day and what was night and how many days had elapsed?
Well, I had, towards the end, I definitely did lose track of that. But more than losing track of the days and so forth, the most important thing that happened to me is that because you sit there, we had no books, we had nothing at the very beginning except towards the end. Was one day I sat there thinking about my family and, you know, talking to them, you know, just in my imaginations. And I saw my baby and I wanted to talk to her and call her by name. And I discovered that I could not remember my baby's name. I had forgotten my own baby's name. And this took me days to remember who her name was. This was one of the worst tortures which happened to me by me and I torturing myself to remember my own child's name.
How did it come back to you?
I think after many days of thinking of nothing and recollecting and when the day, when it did come, I fell asleep. I slept for the day.
Oh, out of relief?
Out of relief. Out of relief of remembering my child's name.
Emma Mashinini, recorded in 1991. We'll hear from former Member of Parliament Helen Suzman after this break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Helen Suzman has spent her life working within the South African political system to change her country's racist policies. She was a member of parliament for 36 years, from 1953 to 1989. For 13 of those years, she was the only member that opposed apartheid. I spoke with her last year after the publication of her memoir In No Uncertain Terms. She retired from Parliament in 1989. I wanted to know if she wished she could be in the new Parliament that will follow the country's first democratic election.
Well, in a way, sometimes when I read things are happening that I'd like to stand up and talk about and argue about and criticize, I am quite sorry that I'm not there. On the other hand, you know, I've had 36 years of active parliamentary work. I am now, alas, 76 years of age, and there are times when people must just get out and let younger people take over.
It's interesting because you were in parliament opposing apartheid, and now that that system is ending and hopefully a new democracy, a new democratic era is about to begin, you won't be in parliament to participate in it.
No, but there I am on the outside keeping a beady eye on everything. I'm really rather pleased that I've lived long enough to see what I never expected to see.
Did you never expect to see it?
No, I honestly didn't. I thought, and I still think, you know, the government could have stayed in power for quite a long time and maintained the status quo. At a cost, of course, a cost of the economy running even further down, at the cost of escalating black resistance, which had already reached very high levels, and at the cost of more violence, all that. But, you know, if you've got the army and you've got the police force on your side, you can hold the situation, as we saw with Yeltsin and Moscow not too long ago.
You were elected to parliament just 5 years after apartheid was codified by the National Party, just 3 years after the Racial Classification Act. So this repressive system had just been put into place in an official way. What did you see as your role as the lone voice of dissent?
Well, I only became the lone voice of dissent some years after I entered parliament because I started as a member of the official opposition, which was the United Party, General Smuts's party, though he himself was dead by then. And we left the party when I say we, there were 11 of us backbenchers who didn't like the equivocal way in which the United Party was fighting apartheid. And we left and formed our own party in 1959. And then there was a snap election in 61 after Dr. Verwoerd had taken South Africa out of the Commonwealth and declared an independent republic. And all my colleagues lost their seats at the 61 election with the exception of myself. And that sad story repeated itself in two subsequent elections in 1966 and 1970. And then in 1974, we got back six of our original members.
So for 13 years, you were the only voice of dissent. Did everybody in Parliament feel like your enemy? I mean, were they unfriendly to you as well as your political opposition?
Some people were quite friendly. They sort of liked me despite my views, but most of them really were very unfriendly. I mean, I never had a meal with any of my colleagues during those years. I used to go upstairs and have a meal upstairs with my secretary and researcher, or I used to have guests in the public dining room at Parliament, but I never sat down with my caucus, with the caucus people of the National Party or the United Party.
Were you ridiculed within Parliament for being anti-apartheid or for being female or for being Jewish?
Well, a bit of all of that, but ridiculed is not quite the word. I was attacked, and that's rather different. It was much more aggressive than ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, let's say being a woman didn't make any difference to me. I mean, I reckoned, you know, I knew that if you wanted to be considered the equal of male colleagues, you had to be better than them. And let me tell you, that wasn't that difficult. And as far as being Jewish is concerned, well, you know, that depended on the way Israel behaved at United Nations, funnily enough. You know, if United Nations voted against South Africa at UN, then at least if Israel voted against South Africa resolution at UN, then I used to come in for a lot of anti-Semitic interjections. On the other hand, after Israel won the Six-Day War, I was treated as a heroine, almost as if I'd done it myself, because the government identified with Israel as a sort of small country surrounded by dark-skinned neighbors, and there was this amazing six-day victory.
How did you keep getting reelected to parliament, having a minority point of view amongst the voting white population?
Well, the sort of constituency that I represented for 36 years was what you would call a silk stocking district. In other words, professional people, educated people, upper middle class people. They never were in competition for jobs with blacks. We could never win a seat in a blue collar area or even in the rural areas, which are very reactionary in South Africa. But, I started out with just a very small majority against the United Party then, not against the Nationalists. We were accused of splitting the opposition because we'd left the United Party, and that's why all my colleagues lost their seats.
You left them because they weren't vocal enough in their opposition to apartheid?
Well, they were very equivocal. They said that the policy was for economic integration but against social and political integration. And we were for integration, so that there was this constant row going on in the caucus with the small body of liberally minded people arguing with the majority in the caucus that we had to oppose laws which in fact were introducing social segregation and political segregation. So we had many rows, and in the end we walked out. I was re-elected because, let me tell you, I was a good MP. I really was. I mean, I worked hard. I was very conscientious. I reported back to my constituents every year. I believe in accountability between constituents and Member of Parliament. I had my name in the phone books. I was available if anybody wanted either help or to complain about something I had done. And I made a lot of good speeches, which were really well reported in the English medium press. I got great coverage. Without them, I certainly could not have survived.
You know, I'm thinking about all the incredible repression that you were trying to fight, the murders of activists, the totally inhumane imprisonment of blacks, and especially of blacks who were leaders of the opposition. And yet you had to voice your opposition in this very kind of genteel setting, the parliament. And granted, I know people were, you know, very vocal in arguing with each other, but still it's kept with argument. I mean, this is the kind of thing people fight to the death over. You know what I mean? This is the kind of thing that people put their lives on the line for. And I'm wondering if it was ever frustrating to be dealing with such incredible repression and oppression, to be dealing with the people responsible for it, and to only be able to argue with them.
Well, I mean, short of taking a gun and shooting them, what else could one do? I mean, it was an opportunity at least to voice one's utter despair and dismay at what the government was doing, and knowing that this would probably be printed in the press the next day, and keep some values alive in that country. Otherwise, the whole thing was just a morass of, as you say, oppressive legislation and people being ill-treated without anybody even knowing about it. So it had its value. It, strangely enough, the government, for all its authoritarianism, had a very healthy respect for the parliamentary system, which was why I, who was known to be opposed to everything, was given very adequate time to debate.
Helen Suzman is a former member of the South African Parliament. Next week, she'll serve as a monitor in the elections. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More from South Africans in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on Fresh Air, more from black and white South Africans who opposed apartheid. Ethel Fugard wrote the first plays that brought white and black actors together on stage in South Africa. His best-known works include Sizwe Banzwe is Dead, The Blood Knot, and Master Harold and the Boys. And poet Dennis Brutus helped lead the movement to expel South Africa from the Olympics. He did time in South Africa's most hellish prison with Nelson Mandela. That and more coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Bosnian Serb forces have resumed shelling Garajda today after an early evening lull. NATO has issued an ultimatum to the Serbs to stop attacking the Muslim town or face Allied airstrikes. Reports reaching the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, say the shelling continued at the same time the Allies issued the ultimatum. Meanwhile, the United Nations has ordered a convoy of peacekeepers en route to Garajda to return to Sarajevo. The BBC's Kathy Jenkins reports.
The convoy had been on the road for more than 24 hours, trying to negotiate its way across Serb-held territory to Garajda. Overnight, its route was blocked by Serb women 10 kilometers away from the town. The head of UN forces, General Sir Michael Rose, ordered it to turn back to Sarajevo. He cited tactical difficulties, but it's almost certain that the general was not prepared for the UN to be further humiliated, nor for the UN peacekeepers to be caught in a vulnerable position if NATO decides to take action against the Bosnian Serbs. The UN convoy, made up of 140 French, British and Ukrainian peacekeepers, was seen perhaps as the last possibility to halt the Serb attack on Garajda without further NATO intervention.
Kathy Jenkins reporting. The Clinton administration says it's not going to change its mind and stop repatriating Haitian refugees. That's even though several hundred Haitians were permitted to come into Miami today. The president says the 400 Haitians that came ashore were an exception.
First of all, they were very close to the United States. So the whole purpose of the return policy is primarily to deter people from risking their lives. Hundreds of people have already drowned trying to come here. These people were only 4 miles from the shore. The second was that we had evidence that the Haitians might have been subject to some abuse by the people who were in control of the boat.
The White House says it's going to seek tighter trade sanctions on Haiti. The administration says that's the best option because of the increase in violence in the country and a political stalemate. The ruling military junta refuses to allow ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to return to power. New York City hospital officials say former President Richard Nixon remains in a deep coma. He suffered a stroke on Monday night at his New Jersey home. Doctors won't discuss his treatment or condition. Nixon had previously rejected the use of a respirator in his living will, a document intended to express the wishes of a very ill or a terminally ill person. Doctors will not discuss that matter either. But two Marine sergeants are stationed at the hospital. They will act as honor guards for former President Nixon in the case of his death. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost a little more than 3 points to close at 3,648. Advancing issues led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. Celebrations are being held around the world today, marking Earth Day. Many American communities are holding some type of tree planting ceremony, and many areas are giving away free seedlings to plant. Residents of Lexington, Kentucky will bury a time capsule with an environmental theme. Cambridge, Massachusetts citizens are working on a Clean Up the St. Charles River campaign. New York City will continue its Earth Day festivities tomorrow with two big events. Earth Day was first celebrated 24 years ago. The University of Pittsburgh has proposed sweeping changes in a major study of breast cancer. Some of the research in the study was found to be fraudulent. NPR's Joe Palka reports.
The University of Pittsburgh has come under intense criticism from breast cancer activists and Congress for the way it managed the breast cancer study. The university had known for 4 years that one of the participating hospitals had falsified patient records. Although the problem didn't appear to affect the study's findings, the National Cancer Institute suspended the study and ordered its director, Bernard Fisher, to step down. Now the university is asking to resume the study. It says it will publish reanalyses of all the studies containing the tainted data. In addition, the university has instituted new procedures for making sure that tainted data is excluded from the study and has formed a new advisory panel that includes breast cancer activists to oversee future research activity. The Cancer Institute expects it will be weeks before the study is allowed to resume. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
Defense contractor Teledyne says it will pay $112 million to settle two whistleblower lawsuits. Teledyne was accused of faking test results on weapons components. It was also accused of estimating its costs too highly. The suits were filed by the federal government and four former Teledyne workers. The contractor says under the tentative agreement, a third case filed by former workers will also be dropped. Teledyne pleaded guilty just last year to selling improperly tested devices to the government. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition of our show, we're featuring interviews with black and white South Africans who opposed apartheid. White South African playwright Ethel Fugard has written plays about the emotional and psychological consequences of apartheid. As a playwright, actor, and director, Fugard defied his country's white supremacist system. When he co-starred in his 1961 play, The Blood Knot, with black actor Zakes Mokhai, they became the first black and white actors in South African history to share a stage. Soon after, Fugard was approached by a group of black actors seeking his help to start a company. Together they formed the Serpent Players. The company was frequently harassed by the authorities. A few members were imprisoned. Some of Fugard's best-known plays include Sizwe Banzwe is Dead and Master Harold and the Boys. In 1986, I asked him if there were any obstacles he faced when he started collaborating with black actor Zakes Mokhai.
Well, firstly, I mean, just for Zakes and myself to get together as two actors and to go up onto a stage, that had never happened before in South Africa, that a black man and a white man had appeared on a stage, and a black actor or a white actor had appeared on a stage at the same time. We were the first in that regard, and all sorts of complications were attendant on that. I mean, in travelling around the country when we eventually took Blood Knot to different cities, Zakes had to travel third class because he had no other choice. I travelled first class. Life was very complicated. Zakes, on a point of principle, refused to carry his reference book. He wanted to make a political statement in his personal life. I knew that if we didn't have that book around with us, that we'd be in trouble. Zakes would be in jail and the show couldn't go on. So I carried the book for Zakes, and whenever the police stopped us, I presented it and pretend that Zakes was working for me, things like that. Yes, there have been lots of complications along those lines. When I collaborated with John Carney and Winston and Chawner to produce Sizwe Bonzi is Dead and The Island, there again, officialdom just couldn't cope with black men as actors. There was no precedent for that. So as far as the sort of paper bureaucracy of South Africa is concerned, John Carney and Winston Chawner worked for me. John was a clerical employee and Winston was my chauffeur. You know, it's the only way we could get away with it.
Did that affect the relationship that you had with each other, since when officials asked, you had to be in the superior employer relationship?
No, you're quite right. Well, no, you learned to play those games as part of your survival mechanism in South Africa. I mean, you know, many, many times, in order to bail Zakes and myself out of a tight spot, for example, with the police, I would put on a heavy Afrikaner act and talk to the policeman as if I was a good Afrikaner and Zakes was my boy, my employee. And Zakes knew that I was doing it in order to, to keep the two of us out of jail. It was a survival mechanism.
Is there a moment when you can point to and say, this is when I realized that the system of apartheid was evil, was unjust?
Yes. I mean, the moment of certainty, the moment when I realized the extent of what that system was doing, came when I, for a variety of reasons, took on a job in Johannesburg, which was to be the clerk of a court, of a criminal court that sent, that tried black people for offences in terms of the passbook that they are compelled by law to carry. And it's when I sat in that courtroom 5 days a week for a period of about 6 months and watched a black man or woman, and sometimes a child, being disposed of at the rate of one every 3 minutes, being sent off to jail. When I saw that tidal wave of humanity being processed by this diabolical machine, that the full extent of what apartheid meant and does and was doing dawned on me when it was brought home to me.
Playwright Athol Fugard recorded in 1986. Poet Dennis Brutus will tell us about his imprisonment after this break. This is Fresh Air. Exiled black South African poet Dennis Brutus barely survived his imprisonment for anti-apartheid activities. Brutus helped lead the movement to expel South Africa from the Olympics. The South African government retaliated by firing him from his job teaching high school English and banning him from participating in any political or social activities. In 1963, Brutus was arrested for breaking the ban. He was shot and nearly killed when he tried to escape. Brutus was patched up to face 18 months of hard labor in South Africa's most brutal prison, Robben Island. That was followed by a sentence of 5 years under house arrest. After 1 year of this house arrest, he signed an exit permit, which allowed him to leave the country, but promised his immediate imprisonment if he ever returned. He emigrated to the United States in 1970. I spoke with Brutus in 1986. He told me that when he started opposing apartheid, he discussed the risks he was taking with his wife.
We talked it through all the way to the point where I said to her that sooner or later I will go to prison, that you can continue opposing for so long, and they will apply various pressures. The ultimate pressure would be imprisonment, and we agreed that I would take that risk as well. The curious thing was that I assured her that if I was in prison, one other possibility still existed, that I might be found dead, and there would be a report that I had been killed trying to escape, and if she ever heard that, she should refuse to believe it, and she should insist on an investigation, because I would not do this if I was in prison. The irony here is that eventually I did precisely what I said I would not do when I was shot in the back by the secret police attempting to escape, and I had, in fact, been attempting to escape. So when she saw me in hospital, she reproached me and said, you had told me you would never do this, you know, what happened? But I think the circumstances justified it. I had escaped from South Africa. I was then on bail, facing a charge for attending a meeting of the South African Olympic Committee. And I got to Mozambique, which was then a Portuguese colony, and the Portuguese returned me to South Africa. But no one knew that I had been returned, and everybody assumed that I had succeeded in escaping. And the only way to make them aware that I had failed was to attempt another escape in a public place and risk being shot, since they were both armed. They had armpit holsters with guns. But I decided the only way to make people aware that I was in fact back in Johannesburg while they were under the impression that I was outside the country, was to attempt another escape.
And you were shot in the back at very close range.
Well, close enough for the bullet to go clear through me. It entered my back and came out of my chest and had penetrated the intestines and just missed the heart. It was pretty serious. I wasn't sure I was going to survive. I remember the man who shot me, Sergeant Hellberg, saying to me as I lay on the sidewalk on the main street in Johannesburg, just outside the Anglo-American Corporation, which is the great mining conglomerate. And I lay on the sidewalk, and Sergeant Hellberg said to me, "Anyway, Brutus, I hope you survive." And I said, "Well, I hope so, too." And in fact, I was taken to a hospital and then operated on after that.
It's almost surprising that you were given good enough medical treatment to survive after that.
Yes. In fact, it's just possible that they lost control of the situation at that time and so settled into the normal routine. Here is a man who was shot. You take him to hospital. You operate on him. And that's it. You know, you try and save his life. There were some complications. The ambulance that came for me, for instance, this was so macabre. The men got out in uniform, and they took out a stretcher, and they looked at me, and they put their stretcher back, and they got back in the ambulance, and they drove off. And I said to Hellberg, who was beside me, "Why are they leaving?" I was very alarmed. And he said, "Well, Brutus, you wouldn't want them to lose their job, would you? This is an ambulance for whites, and so you'll have to wait for the black ambulance to come along." And then when it did come, six members of the police got into the ambulance with me and sat there with notebooks poised and started questioning me about people that they should contact on my behalf. But clearly this was in an effort to get leads. And then perhaps the most Kafkaesque part of it was when the doctors started operating, the police insisted on being in the operating theater. And the doctors protested and said, "Well, look, you're covered with germs. You've got to be sterile. We can't have you here." So they said, "Well, hold it." And they went off and came back all masked and in gloves and covered boots and whatnot. And they stood there at the table. And the doctors then said, "Well, we can't work with you standing around us. It's impossible." And they refused to leave. And so I sat up and said that I think these men are hoping to get a statement out of me, perhaps under anesthetic. So perhaps I should make a statement now, and then they would leave you to get on with the work. So they agreed, and they took out their notebooks. And I said, "Well, I regret nothing. I would do this again if necessary, because I think this is an unjust system, and that's all I intend to say." And then they withdrew to the doorway of the theater and stood there. But I think they gave up at that point.
You were later taken to Robben Island, which is considered the most hellish of all the prisons in South Africa. And it's supposedly unescapable. It's supposed to be escape-proof.
Yes, well, no one has ever escaped. That's true. Those who managed to get off the island were usually found dead. Their corpses would be washed up on the beach of Cape Town subsequently. No one, as far as I know, has succeeded in escaping and living. And, of course, I spent time there with people like Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Governor Mbeki, and Ahmed Kathrada. We broke stones together. We were given rocks every day and a hammer, and we broke rocks.
Could you describe the prison a little bit and why it is so unescapable?
Well, it's heavily guarded, heavily fortified. The wardens were all white. The prisoners are all black. automatic rifles, there's barbed wire, there's sentry posts, there are helicopters which circle the island. And in fact, when I got there, I was part of a span, as it's called, or a team, that had to carry rocks out of the sea and up the beach to build a wall around the island. And in fact, one of my poems deals with that because I was so covered with bruises and I was beaten while I was working that I became a kind of a spectacle. And every evening when we stripped, we were required to stand naked outside the cells and be searched. The wardens would come along and inspect my bruises, and I felt a little like a freak in the circus, a two-headed calf, or a bearded lady, or a tattooed lady, as I called it. So perhaps I should just read it at this point. For a while, I was the tattooed lady of the prison, and wardens would come to our section and get me to strip and stare and whistle in mingled pleasure and horror at the great purple bruise that ran from my neck down my back, from my neck to my thighs in a purple mass. What was I then? Mute, enduring reproach, heroic endurer, Christianly hero, or submissive fool? What was I then that I cannot now imagine, cannot now judge?
Did you consider the beatings that you were subjected to and the hard labor as well a form of torture of political prisoners?
I think so. Although it was so random and unsystematic, they just decided to teach us that Robben Island was really Hell Island, and so they beat us at the slightest provocation, and very often without provocation. It was really an attempt to demoralize us. And they saw political prisoners as far more dangerous than murderers or rapists or anybody else. And so it was important for them to humiliate us because they saw us as a threat to the system.
Robben Island had a mix of political prisoners like yourself and people who were there on criminal offenses. Did you mix it all, and was there any attempt to politicize the criminals?
There were, when I arrived there, there were, I became one of 1,100 political prisoners. And in addition, we had 200 who were there for multiple murders, multiple rapes. The government described them as the scum of the prison system or the dregs of the prison system. They were the worst in the country. And these 200 were then put in charge of the political prisoners. They took us to work, they gave us our food, they beat us up. So mix is probably not the right word. Certainly we were together, but they were dominant over us on behalf of the guards. So the guards, in fact, simply gave the orders, but these orders were carried out, and the supervision was by what were called often blowbikies, and that's translated as blue jackets. And they were lifers, people who would never come out of prison and who therefore wore a different uniform. They wore little blue jackets. And they were rather proud of their status. And they also, of course, collaborated with the wardens in beating us up and would then be rewarded for having performed these duties. Often they ate our food as well. They were due to deliver it to us in our cells each evening. But if they chose to, of course, we went without it.
South African poet Dennis Brutus, recorded in 1986. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on the siege of Garajda?
Well, we'll have a report on NATO's ultimatum to the Bosnian Serbs. Lift the siege of Garajda or there will be airstrikes. And we'll be hearing about that as well as some information about what has happened in Garajda. Also, a report on the United Farm Workers Union. It has been a year since the death of its founder, Cesar Chavez, and we'll hear what has happened to the union in this time. Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Dan Rostenkowski, has spoken out about what needs there might be for taxes to pay for a new health care system. We'll hear about that as well.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During the years black political groups were banned in South Africa, the voice of Desmond Tutu was not silenced. As bishop of South Africa's Anglican Church, he was able to speak out in his country and around the world in opposition to apartheid. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984. That year, he said something to me that he won't have to say anymore.
Although I'm a bishop in the Church of God, I am 52 years of age, and maybe one or two people might be willing to be persuaded to think that I am reasonably responsible. I can't vote in my country. And yet a child of 18, because he or she is white, can vote. Now, I mean, how do any people justify that kind of denial of access to the political decision-making processes?
Desmond Tutu, recorded in 1984. Next week, South Africa holds its first all-race elections. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. All the music on today's show was composed by South African pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, preparing South Africa's broadcast journalists for election coverage and democracy. We talk with John Madison. He's directing election coverage for the South African Broadcasting Company. He has also reported on South Africa for National Public Radio. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.